Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Leave.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself the Wire.
The Wire podcast, where me and Vince Mancini go through every single episode of The Wire
and talk about it.
Thank you once again for joining us for the world's only The Wire podcast. A wonderful show, The Wire, a show that puts the fun in defund the police. Hey, we're having a good time.
Politics, everybody.
Politics. Please give us 5 stars and a review on whatever podcast app that you're using. Whatever way you can rate it, please do. Text it to your friends. Do all the things that you can do to help us, because this is a new one, and we're trying to make sure that everyone gets a chance to listen to us talk about the best TV show from the early 2000s that's not about Italians. I'm trying to qualify it in case any of our Sopranos listeners are like, wow.
That's not about Italians or executive produced by Mark Wahlberg.
Yes, exactly. Good point.
Yeah, that's an important
one. You have to separate, because people, there's a lot of Entourage fans who listen to this and they're like, please do not besmirch the good name of Entourage, a show about fucking bad. That's what I think the show was about. Anyways, today...
We can get in. I mean, I could do a whole 20 minutes on Entourage, but, you know, that's not why we're here.
But let's introduce our guest and talk about what episode we're talking about. Today, we're going to be talking about, from season one of The Wire, episode 4, Old Cases. And our guest today, he is a returning champion, 2-time Pod Yourself a Gun guest, a Sopranos podcast. He also has his own podcast about fashion, Free Validation. You can also read his wonderful articles in the LA Times. Everyone, please welcome back to the podcast, Dave Schilling.
Hey, guys. Wow. A new show to talk about. I wish we could just go back and watch Sopranos again.
Yeah, I know.
Someday.
Let's just double back. Let's do it one more time.
That'll be season 3.
Yeah. We thought about it, and we were just like, what if the podcast just goes on forever of just the Sopranos over and over and over again? Because I kind of forget. You know, what happens.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of wonderful Easter eggs for you to uncover on your 12th rewatch of this.
Yeah. Brand. No, my brain is like painting the Golden Gate Bridge with, you know, like at a certain point, I'm just going to keep re-remembering and re-forgetting stuff.
That's kind of nice to know, though. Like, if you get, once you get like really old, you start getting dementia or something, you can rewatch shows you've already seen and be like, this is the best show ever.
Yeah.
And that's what Junior would do with Mannix.
Yeah, Mannix? That's right.
Oh, yeah. My favorite episode of Mannix is on again.
Oh, good. Arliss is on again.
Arliss.
He's also a big Arliss fan. Yeah. So, hey, this is about The Wire, though, dude. Do you like The Wire?
I love The Wire. I have The Wire on Blu-ray for no reason, because you can watch it on HBO Max right now.
Physical
but
media
I believe in
is important.
Media.
They can't retcon it if you own it on Blu-ray.
That's true. That's true.
But they won't George Lucas special edition season 2 of The Wire and take Frank Sabaka out or anything. Replace him with fucking, I don't know, Paul Sorvino or something.
Yeah, what would they retcon on The Wire? I'm trying to think, like, I would... If it were me and I were George Lucasing it, I'd be like, can we show Ziggy's dick? Because I don't think we ever really get to see his like full hog, and they allude to it.
Yeah, there would have been an outcry if that happened today about them not hanging dong, I feel like.
That's true.
I was going to say, you know, Michael K. Williams, in his posthumously released autobiography, said he wanted to have more gay sex in The Wire. Huh. Which is weirdly a text message that Matt sends me all the time.
Well, you know, I just...
It's 3 a.m, dude. Leave me alone.
Yeah, but there should be more butt fucking. Like, I do text you that a lot. But, you know...
Hog yourself the wire. I don't know where
Bite
to go with
yourself
that.
A wire. Yeah. I feel like they, like, got all donged out with Oz. And they're like, that's our dong show. And so they made it so that all the other actors, all the other shows they had, they're like, no, we're not hanging dong, which is kind of unfortunate. But do you have a favorite character in The Wire? Is there someone that you love a lot or relate to? Or
oh boy, I mean, I almost want to ask you guys who you think I'm like. Lester Freeman, maybe like a little Lester there.
You got a little Lester.
Yeah, maybe a little Bubs.
He's definitely Bubs. Lester's probably the most fashionable, wouldn't you say?
He's for the sure. coolest guy for sure. Yeah, yeah, he's got yeah. those really great tweed suits and mm-hmm. his little glasses, and he's making his little tiny furniture.
You can tell he likes jazz.
Oh yeah, and he can drink McNulty under the table too.
100%.
He's a big alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a drunk, but like he knows how to like keep it together because he just is so smooth. Yep. At being a drunk, which yep. is something the Irish are physically incapable of being. It genetically makes you more violent or more likely to
yeah.
spawn children.
Yeah, you
and
can
then
tell...
ignore them.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Every the more the freckles, the more the propensity for violence.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
That's yeah, my version of phrenology.
Yeah, that, I think freckleology actually is real, though. I remember the kids growing up in my neighborhood. There was this one like Irish family, and they were like all of their kids were ginger, like every single one, which I was like, this is an anomaly, right? You can't have all gingers. And the one with the least amount of freckles was like the most cool, but the one who was just all freckles was just like the most violent kid in the neighborhood. He was
yeah.
like, he was an old timey street mick, but it was like 1990, so it was kind of weird. Well, he was kind of a throwback.
Wait, were you friends with the kid from The Sandlot?
Yeah,
he's a big Scientologist now. I'm
and
sure.
Absolutely brutal. Oh, just no. a complete bare knuckle badass. Whooping people. Don't cross him on the street.
Supposedly that was a Neanderthal gene, was having red hair. That was something that we got from the Neanderthals.
Oh, I heard that the redhead is going away, that genetically, because they're so disgustingly unappealing. Nobody's fucking them.
I mean, I have... See,
oh, God, I'm going to get canceled for this.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I'm
done,
sort dude. Of a daywalker because I got, like, I don't have red hair, but I have a red facial hair. So,
yeah.
And, like, there was a couple times where I was dating redheaded women, and I was like, oh, no, is this, like, am I cursing my children with ginger genes now that they're going to have it on both sides?
Yeah. But, my mom is a ginger.
Married a brunette, thank God.
My mom is a ginger, and I'm not sure how the genetics part works. Mm-hmm. So is there a chance... That my children will be ginger?
Probably not, considering now you've introduced Asian genes to your child.
Oh yeah, that's right. Dave, are you still there? Oh
yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
what the fuck?
I thought you were frozen.
No, I was texting my girlfriend. What the fuck?
Oh, that makes sense. I'm just waiting.
Hey,
for
babe,
the power
just
to
talking
go
about
out.
Redheads over here.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to this.
That's fair. That's
I
fair.
Said I made my joke on. About the kid from the Sandlot, and now I'm finished.
Sometimes well, okay, you get into riff mode and you can't move on. It's just that's one of the drawbacks of riffing.
That's why I'm shutting the fuck up so we can move on.
Wow. I mean, I just like, what are your thoughts about gingers?
I hate them.
All right, we'll leave it there. Well, this is not a podcast about gingers. Gross. No, this is a podcast. This is a podcast about The Wire, and we of course cannot start the podcast without first playing the theme song.
If you pod. Through the garden, you better
pod.
Watch your back. Well, I beg your
pod.
Pardon.
Podcast.
Track.
Pod.
To Jesus, he'll save your
The Wire.
Soul. You gotta keep the devil
Pod.
Down in the hole.
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 Pod.
Podcast.
All right, ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, today we're talking about from season 1, episode 4 of The Wire, Old Cases. And this episode came out June 23rd, 2002. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
That's right, Matt. I think what you're trying to say is that in order to evaluate
nope,
any piece
I
of
asked
art...
asked you for the synopsis.
Oh, shit. All right. Well, I don't listen to you a lot of the time.
You are on autopilot.
That's right. The synopsis is what I'm going to read. Detective McNulty tries to prove he is the smartest one in the room, but gets overshadowed by Detective Freeman. So McNulty tries to fuck Kima to prove that at least he's the sexiest one in the room.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
That is what happened. That's the whole episode. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So what happened at the time that this episode came out, Vince?
That's right, Matt. I think what you're trying to say is that we cannot evaluate art divorced from its cultural context, and that therefore we have to add that cultural context back in, and we do that through something that we call the back in the day machine.
It's a bad time for newspapers. The news hole is shrinking as advertising dollars continue to decline.
There ain't no back in the day.
Machine tells the tale, son.
See, I added that new part. There ain't no back in the day. That's from our listener, Horse, who also helped us do the logo.
Thank you, Horse.
Gold Star
thank
listener.
You, Horse, first. Yeah, suggested, hey, you know what? At some point, Cheese yells, there ain't no back in the day slur.
Cheese.
And so I added that.
Yeah, I could say it, you know.
I know you can, but we're not going to say. I don't even know if I want to play someone else saying it in a bumper. Yeah. That's how not racist I am.
All right. Well, gold star for you,
buddy.
Did you
guys ask me onto the show just so that someone could say it?
I mean, someone needs to say. No.
We're going all the way back in the day to June 23rd, 2002. Mm. All the way back, more than 20 years ago. Whew.
Yeah.
Time flies, you guys. A few things that were going on back then.
I was taking the SATs.
Oh, nice. Ann Landers, the straight-talking advice giver to generations, dead at 83.
Oh, fuck. Ann Landers died then?
Yep.
Yeah, I thought she lived at least till like 2012.
Yeah, me too. Hmm. Don't they keep running Ann Landers
advice
columns? I think
one of their children still does one of the columns. I'm not sure which one. Epi Lederer, who as the syndicated columnist Ann Landers was widely considered responsible for bringing the advice column into the modern era, died on Saturday at her home in Chicago of multiple myeloma, a cancer of the bone marrow. Well, that sucks.
Okay.
Mrs. Lederer, who became Ann Landers in 1955, avoided the quavering prose and Victorian euphemism of an earlier generation of newspaper sob sisters in favor of hard-nosed, often witty discussion of contemporary woes that, as she liked to say, would twirl your turban.
Whoa.
Well, all right. A little problematic. I'm glad you're dead now.
Wow. Calm down.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
A petite, elegant woman who favored high heels and silk, Mrs. Lederer had delicate features and a voice of pure ground glass.
And an ass that could melt butter. Damn, she was fine. Ooh, that girl was hot.
Now let me explain her mouth. Her dirty little mouth would give me the greatest advice.
She advised millions of readers on problems as varied as acne, alcoholism, and AIDS, often in spirited competition with her identical twin sister, who wrote the advice column Dear Abby.
That's right. I forgot that they were identical twins.
I know. And
identical jobs, too. That's kind of weird.
That's how identical they were.
And the same husband?
I hope, dude.
Yeah, one lucky.
That's so hot. And twins! Remember beer commercials?
Of course, and twins!
Twins! Oh, incest! Okay.
An ardent liberal on most social issues, she was deeply traditional in matters of personal morality. She never smoked or drank alcohol and remained, in her words, a nice Jewish girl from Sioux City, Iowa, whose public expressions of annoyance never got much stronger than, oh, banana oil.
Hmm. Banana oil?
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is what she rubs on her juicy butt.
I'd rub my banana oil on there.
Yeah. That's crazy that she's like, these got to be the only Jews in Iowa.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still the only Jews giving advice to strangers.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. That's
no question.
We keep that, you know, in the community. That's what we do. We don't give our advice.
Put a little string around it. Another news. Crisis of confidence drags stocks down. The major market averages fell in 12 of the past 14 weeks, even as the economy has steadily improved and corporate profits have consistently risen.
Familiar story.
Layoffs have mostly stopped, and most working Americans admit they are not fearful about losing their jobs. So what's the problem? For an answer, you might ask Martha Stewart, or IM clone ex-CEO Sam Waksal, or disgraced Tyco chief Dennis Kozlowski, or any of the other bigwigs of corporate America who are now under investigation or arrest for financial shenanigans.
Oh, that's right. And Martha Stewart's about to go to jail for a little bit.
Yeah, dude. Remember point, when right? she tanked the whole stock market? Like,
yeah,
you can't
dude,
believe
that was
in
crazy
Martha Stewart. What can you believe in? In other news, anthrax in mail was newly made, investigators say. This was 1 year since the anthrax mailing story.
Yeah, I remember that.
Scientists have determined that the anthrax powder sent through the mail last fall was fresh, made no more than 2 years before it was sent, senior officials said. The new finding has concerned investigators who say it indicates that whoever sent the anthrax could make more and strike again.
Man, that never happened again, did it? It literally never happened again.
Did they ever find out who did that?
I had to look this up. It's very interesting. They pinned it on this guy, Bruce Edwards Ivins, a scientist at the government's biodefense labs in Fort Detrick, Maryland.
What?
Ivins was put under periodic surveillance, and an FBI document stated that he was, quote, an extremely sensitive suspect in the 2001 anthrax attacks.
He's very sensitive. Don't talk to him like that. He's so sensitive.
On July 29th, 2008.
Don't yell at me. I'll blow anthrax in your face.
Ivins committed suicide.
Stop eating my leftovers in the fridge.
Oh, go ahead. Eat them. See what happens.
You're going to eat something else. Some fresh powder. And yeah, it's not snow. It's anthrax.
I hope you like cow because this is made from cow, I think. I don't know.
In 2008, Ivins committed suicide with an overdose of acetaminophen.
Oh.
Oh, fuck. That's how he did it? That's right. The worst way to go.
Prosecutors declared him the sole culprit based on DNA evidence. But then there was a 2011 report that cast doubt on the government's conclusion that Ivins was the perpetrator. So basically, we got a whole Epstein thing going on here. We don't really know.
That's crazy.
It was probably
dude.
Epstein.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was probably him, dude.
Yeah.
It's always who you most expect. That is kind of insane, though, that he committed suicide. Like, for those of you who don't know, first of all, don't commit suicide.
Please.
But if you absolutely have to.
Unless you're a child molester.
Well, no. Kill yourself immediately. But if you must, acetaminophen, taking an overdose of that will just, I think you're just, your liver shuts down and then you die painfully. Mm. So don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do any suiciding. This has been
don't
a message
do suicide
from Matt Lee.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the stories in your neck of the woods.
So that's what was happening at the time. We had anthrax was out. You know, people thought terrorism was everywhere. The economy was just going. It was nosediving. And Martha Stewart was getting caught up in the prison industrial complex. Shit is going down in weird ways. And with all of that said, now we can get into our discussion of this episode, old cases. General thoughts real quick. What did we think of this episode? Vince?
I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I feel like this is, it's another classic YR episode. It's setting up the big hooky tropes, which is sort of like that's the skeleton of the Wire, is those things that, you know, you want to see, like the real, like, classic TV hooks. And in this case, they're sort of setting up this team up that's going to happen between our new favorite character, Omar, and he's going to team up with our other faves, McNulty and Bubbles and Kima, like our classic team of opposites that are going to come together and be a ragtag investigatory team. So that's like the big hook.
An odd couple, if you will.
Yeah, an odd thruple or quadruple, however you want to see it. But of course, it being The Wire, the thing that makes The Wire great is sort of after it draws you in with that, it's going to give you some real shit about how, like, the incentive structure of police works in a big city. And then there's also a little bit about the sort of psychology of the corner boys. So it's got a little bit of everything, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. Dave, did you like this episode?
Yeah, this is, an interesting episode of The Wire, because the show is, as we know, called The Wire. Well, there's no wiretaps for three episodes.
Nope. At least
there's a tap, but no wires.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of like imagery of wiretapping and surveillance in the opening credits in the first episode. Not to detract or distract from this episode, but the first episode, I barely understood it when I first watched it. Who the fuck are these people? What's going on? Why do I care? It was this episode where it all locked into place for me on my first watch, which is like, oh, I see what this is supposed to be every week. This is almost like the pilot. Mm-hmm. This is like the first episode. There's that great scene, and not to get ahead of ourselves, but there's that great scene where they figure out how the shooting happened.
Yes.
And the most fucks in any scene in any television show ever.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It's super like gimmicky, it's like and it works, I would say.
Yeah, because they played it straight.
Yeah. Yeah, they played it 100% straight, and they did something that you don't really ever see in TV in a way that feels natural, which is like you see actual detective work, like you see them kind of figuring it out. I feel like most of the time when you're watching detective work on TV, it's like literally just it's Law and Order. You go up to a guy who's like, you know, filing boxes, and he's like, of course, you know, he's answering his questions, but he's also like, listen, these boxes aren't going to stack themselves. I really got to get back to the box stacking. And they don't really like so much solve crimes as they do kind of just like gather evidence for some trial you're going to see later. I feel like you're not getting what it actually looks like to do police work. And in this show, for the first time, I remember the first time I saw this scene, I was like, not only is it hilarious that they just say fuck and variations of that, but also the way that they were figuring out the angle of the bullet was actually like, I was like, oh, this is actually how they would do it. This
yeah,
is actually
I think that
them
whole
thing,
collecting that whole,
info.
Yeah, I think that whole scene is like, it's very representative in that, like on one level, it's kind of corny, like in the in the sense that you're watching this sort of Aaron Sorkinized competence porn of these guys.
Sure.
Like, you know, exposing themselves as great detectives in front of your eyes. But I think because of the tone, like the tone is genuine. I feel like most cop shows at this time would be all about these cops being very like romantic and sentimental about like the victim, and these guys are the exact opposite. Like that's not what drives them to do detective work, and in the process of doing it, like they're the opposite of romantic. They're super super unsentimental about it, but they're very and I think that makes the competence porn aspect of it work really well.
Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of procedural cop shows that are unromantic and very like straight about the investigation of a murder. If it's like a Law and Order or Criminal Minds or NCIS or whatever, it's like there's a murder, cigar, and then they pull up off the fucking tarp over the body, and then the coroner guy or the whatever investigator is like, here are all the things that happened. Let me explain this to you. And then the detective goes, And then he does a soliloquy about what he thinks occurred, and it takes forever.
Yeah.
This is almost a silent movie.
Right. Yes. Yes.
It is so mundane. Mm-hmm. It is so boring.
And they're both like competent, but also hilariously ridiculous. I mean, at one point, while McNulty is trying to figure out the angle of the shot that killed her, he pulls his gun out, points it at himself.
Yeah.
And then the guy, the landlord, is like, oh, yeah. He walks away.
You're like, why the fuck is this cop pointing a gun at himself? And
you can just point your finger at yourself.
You don't need to take a loaded gun out to figure out angles.
Hopefully he didn't adjust the pull of his trigger like Przybylowski. Like he did Przybylowski's pistol. That's dangerous.
Yeah, that's an instant death sentence. But yeah, it's like the scene itself is just so, it's competence porn, and it's also just hilarious in its, I don't know, in the way that they're still kind of buffoons. The network TV detective is always competent in a way that it's like, wow, he's like a superhero. These guys are dumbasses, but they know kind of the basics of doing good police work, and it's fun to see.
They understand physics and how a bullet travels. Yeah. That's it. That's all they know. A body falls like this, a bullet goes like this, and this is how far you need to be to shoot a person.
Right. They know bullet goes straight, and that's kind of what you need to know. There is no curving bullet.
If me stand here, bullet go here, bullet come out this way. Okay. Let's go get drink.
Yeah, let's go drink now.
Let's have
cheat
sex with
wife.
Women.
Yeah. But yes, it is. I love this episode. My thoughts are just that this, to me, is the episode where The Wire really becomes its own thing. It's like
that scene
really
is so enjoyable
itself.
To watch that I don't even mind that I don't quite believe that someone is going to get a direct hit with a handgun from outside a window. And kill a person that way. Like, I don't necessarily see that happening, but they made me believe it in the moment, and that's all that matters. The having tap, tap, tap as like your, you know, motif for this whole killing is very Hollywood.
Absolutely.
But it sort of works. It works on The Wire. Just you
it
know,
works
the way they play it.
And let's be real. It's a bop. That is all I wanna see. Baby, show me. Anyways, so
I think it partly works because they're so reluctant. Like, you know, other shows, they would have been like bloodhounds on the scent or whatever.
Right,
like, we're gonna catch this guy. And these guys are
a
like
cold case, let's do it.
These guys are like, ugh, really with this shit? Like, we gotta all right, I guess we'll do it just because we know the other guy that we work with sucks at his job, so we might as well go back over it and see what happens.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. I also have a clip of the fuck scene that, you know,
the
I think is,
fuck scene.
Well, no, the scene where they say fuck, fuck, fuck. I call it the fuck scene. Here's a clip. I really like B2K is the thing.
Cool.
I
think that's a good song.
I mean, it's just a fucking jam, dude.
That was a great time for music.
That was a great time.
Jagged Edge, B2K, 112. I mean, all the legends.
As soon as Omarion went solo, I was like, I'm done. Yeah. I'm too old for this.
That's a mistake.
There needs to be more hip-hop bands. That's what I said.
It's like when Coco left SWV. It's a mistake.
Absolutely.
Don't do that, Coco.
Yeah, fucking, you
know. They need you, Coco, and you
Lauryn
need
Hill leaving the Fugees. It's like, but why?
Fergie leaving Black Eyed Peas.
Exactly.
Why would you do that?
Wait,
why
she left the Black Eyed Peas?
Yeah, remember she did the Duchess, the album?
Oh, I can't believe I'm finding out this way.
Can you drop some London Bridge in there?
If I could, I would. But I will in post.
Okay. London
Bridge, wanna go down. But yeah, it's to me, this is just like, I love this episode. Every part about it is great. And we start off with, I think, probably the best cold open so far. I mean, I would say usually the first, you know, the pilot cold open, the Snot Boogie, This America Man, like that's a great cold open. But this one is fucking fantastic.
All right, on three, motherfuckers.
One, two, three.
I'm embarrassed for y'all.
Herc and Carve, our two dumbest cops, are trying to get a desk either in or out of a room, and people keep showing up and keep looking at them and going, you fucking idiots. You're just not strong enough. Let me try. They all try to do it. McNulty, Daniels.
I love that. It says so much about Daniels that he comes in and he's like, I can help out with this. He takes off his jacket. He's going to roll up his sleeves and get in there. And it's gratifying to watch him do that. And then, of course, you know, when he realizes what dumbasses they are, he's like, I'm never taking my suit jacket off ever again.
Oh, it's so great. And because you see Freeman looking and you can tell, oh, Freeman knows what's up. But of course, he's not going to say anything because why would he say anything? It would ruin how hilarious this is. And also, every time he actually solves crime in the past, they send him to the pawn shop unit. So better to not actually solve a puzzle than to actually do anything at all, than say anything. So he just watches, and then you realize that when Herc says, at this rate, we're never going to get it in.
Well, at this rate, we're never going to get it in. What?
In.
Unbelievable. Unbe-fucking-leavable.
You see, one side was pushing, and the other side was also pushing when they should have been pulling.
So my question: why did he want to get the desk in? Like, he was going to sit at a desk? That doesn't seem like a hurt thing to do. Why does he want the desk in there?
But that's the thing. Nobody knows. Yeah. This is art. This is the fucking art of it,
right,
guys.
That's right.
Yeah, this is the entire show. Yeah. The whole show is represented in this one scene.
I agree completely. It really is, though. It's about lack of communication between people based on either ego or based on the fact that just regular police competitiveness. Mm-hmm. Like, it is the entire show all in wrapped up in one scene. No, the actual good detective not doing the job because that to do the job is just not worth it in this system. It's like, it's perfect. It's the perfect scene. When everyone thinks they're smarter than the next person.
When McNulty comes in, he's like, in? You're trying to get it in?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh no, you want to get it out, basically, is what he's saying. Yeah. And that's what McNulty does every time for five seasons.
That's right.
Why are you guys doing this when you should be doing this?
Mm. Right.
And I'm going to totally blow up every fucking thing you're trying to accomplish because I know better than you.
Yeah, yeah.
He's such a turd.
Yeah, he's a real piece of shit. But you know what? He's
I like
good,
him.
Good, natural police.
I mean, I assume everybody identifies with McNulty in that way. Like, I feel like that was me at every job where, like, I couldn't help myself from being like, no, you guys should do this because this is the good way. Like, not realizing that nobody actually wants to... Like, accomplishing things is not the point.
Yeah. Thanks for trying to get us to do more work, asshole.
Yeah, stupid.
People just want to sit and collect a paycheck, and that includes the people who are in charge of figuring out who does murders. Good to know. But this episode has, I think, a lot of interesting storylines. I've kind of split it into a couple. One is the punch and the pit, in which we have, this is encapsulating Bodhi's escape, Carve and Herc chasing him, and Dee's other body that he got, which was this girl. And then we also, the detail does exhaustion. This is the scenes with Freeman doing good police stuff, Kima McNulty showing their love lives versus their police lives, and then also Bub seeing how the other half lives, and of course Omar. And, you know, our introduction to him. So let's start off, I think, with the punch and the pit. So we left off the last episode with a failed raid at the pit. Not only did they already move the stash house the day before, but the stash house also got hit the day before by Omar. So they raided and they found nothing. And we see Mahone getting knocked out by Bodhi and then Bodhi getting his ass kicked. So in this episode, you see that this punch has actually caused Mahone to have an excuse to literally retire with pay.
And he's thrilled about it. Like, he could not be any happier about it.
Because of a medical, you know, it's like, so one of his vertebrae is fractured or something. I mean, Bodhi hit him, but like, damn, how did he hurt his spine is the real question. I mean,
old man falling on concrete, anything can go wrong.
Lots of bones become fragile at that point.
Oh, not me, man. My bones stay strong because I drink milk.
I mean, you can hear just like the ecstasy in his voice when he's talking about his various ailments, which is great. Like, just the excitement when he's recounting every single one of his symptoms. And then it gets even better when he's toasting his special occasion that he's going to get to retire with 66% pay. And,
right.
And for his special occasion, he pulls out like the shittiest plastic fifth of hobo vodka to toast this wonderful occasion. I think that to me is my favorite detail in that scene.
Oh, I love that detail. I also love that Daniels is like, hey, before you put in your papers and stuff, maybe like take some time, think about it. And he's like, no. See, I already got a plan. My brother-in-law runs a video rental store, and I'm going to go work there with him.
I got a line on a business that's going to the stars, and that is
in 2002, video, no less.
Yeah, video rental.
I got this guy. His name's Harvey Netflix. He's got this idea to send people fucking movies in the mail. What a fucking jabroni.
Yeah, what an idiot.
One thing people are always going to need is videotapes of porn.
That's right. Brick and mortar porn stores all around the county.
People love to get recommendations from their neighbors. You go in. And the clerk says, what are you guys, are you like fisting? And I say, of course I do. Do you have interracial fisting? And he said, come on back. Yeah. I got something just right.
If there's one thing that men love, it's going in person to a store and behind a bead curtain to look at porn videos.
You look like a sophisticated kind of guy. What do you think about, you know, we got a housewife. Maybe she gets stuck in her washing machine.
Underneath the coffee table. This happens to people every day.
Yeah, for the kids, we got the lady stuck in a windowsill, you know?
She may or may not be your stepmom. If you want it,
we can get it. But yeah, I love that he's going to work at a video rental store. Just like I think Blockbuster was still around. I mean, there was still video.
Oh yeah, they were
absolutely
around.
Yeah. I had my first DVD player probably in 2001, 2000.
Yeah,
right. So this is accidentally a really, really funny joke.
Perfect. Yeah, I don't like. They had no idea that what a joke this was in terms of, you know, what a perfect encapsulation of this guy's like investment skills.
Right, just a dumb cop who's just like, no, I'm going to retire and I have a great plan of a business that will never go under.
They're called non-fungible tokens, Tone.
And then his partner, Polk, is feeling kind of sad, and they have a great scene together in which Mahone tells him, hey, maybe we could go out together. And I have a clip of that.
Have a nice life, Lieutenant.
What the fuck am I gonna do, Patty?
What do you say we go out together?
What do you mean?
I mean, it only hurts for a minute. I'm serious. You know those stairs where they send us down the basement?
Yeah.
It's dark down there. You go up 8 or 9 steps, let go of the rail, take a little jump.
I break my fucking neck like that.
You don't break nothing. You do a little dance on those steps. You're up to 2/3 with me. And maybe you sue the city, get a little money. Can't say we don't deserve it.
They absolutely deserve it, and not in the way they think.
A bit of light fraud never hurt nobody.
I love it. He's like, I got this great plan for us to both go out on retirement at 2/3 pension. What's the plan? You gotta fall down some stairs.
Maim yourself. Maim yourself.
You gotta get just hurt enough to live, but not too unhurt to not go out on 2/3 pay. Like, that is such a stupid plan. As if he thought, like, hey, I have this idea. Like, you don't need to. This is something I'm sure Polk has considered. He is a drunk who hates his job already. Everyone who's a drunk at work always thinks, all I need to do is fall down some stairs and I can get, at the very least, some disability for a little bit. I love that so much.
Something to point out, something to remember about this show, and specifically this story right now, this is probably based on something that actually happened.
Oh,
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
That David Simon heard about this while he was reporting in Baltimore, and he put that in the show. Somebody did this.
Of course.
And that is so fucked up. It's sad.
Oh, I love it, man. I mean, here's the thing, though. If you're really committed though to being like, I just want out of this job, and you throw yourself down some stairs, whether or not it was an accident or you did it on purpose, that person should just get their 2/3 pay and be allowed to retire.
You hurt yourself fair and square, and you should be rewarded for it. I mean, listen,
you should be rewarded.
Yeah, you can't tell me there aren't days when you're staring at your laptop screen and thinking, how much more scrolling would I have to do to give myself carpal tunnel just enough to be able to retire at 2/3 pension? If that was an option for me, you better believe I would be just doing even more scrolling.
The idea of anyone whose job it is to be on a computer getting any sort of pension is pretty funny.
Basically, anyone. Does anyone? No one gets pensions other than teachers and cops and firefighters at this point.
Yeah,
right?
Anyone who has a union, they get a pension. Yeah, anyone. Yeah. There was a time, actually, when even non-union jobs, like IBM used to have pensions. Yeah. You know, that, but... The all pensions
now
got
you get a 401k, which is you give them money and they invest it for you, and they don't
they
let you
make more,
they don't
more
let you
money.
Have the money so that someday the money's still there.
Oh, but, and then when you do take the money early, there's a penalty.
There's a
so
penalty.
The government
for it.
Gets some.
It's such an insane scam that somehow got normalized, and it's like I always think about that, like. There had to be a few people at a business at some point, like employees who are like, hey, okay, so we're not doing a pension, but we're doing this other thing. It's called a 401k. There had to be like people going, no. That was before you gave us money in retirement. Now you're just taking my money and saying later.
Yes, but think about the market. It will grow. The market will grow your
money. Okay,
well,
I'll put my own money. I could do that myself. And they're like, not tax-free, you
but
can't. And it's like, yes, you can.
You're stupid, okay? Let's consider the fact that you're very dumb and you couldn't do this by yourself because of your ignorance, your lack of knowledge. So what we're going to do is we're going to get this little garden of money. We're going to pour water on it every year. We're going to pour a little bit more water. Oh, it's your water, by the way.
Yeah.
I just want to keep in mind this is your water and you have to pay for it. But we're going to put it on there. And then maybe if you don't die of a heart attack or depression or whatever, you'll get that.
Yeah. Or your kids will get it if they live long enough.
The stock market could crash. Yeah. And then it's all gone.
They just ride away on a broomstick like, I should never have trusted the financial advisor from Witch Corp LLC. Oh, man.
Hey, speaking of Witch Corp, we have to take a break to do some ads.
Oh, my God. Yeah. This is the first time that this has ever been done. Ladies and gentlemen. Before we go on, we do have to have this quick word from our sponsors. And by the way, I'm so sorry, but this is We Got Babies. This is a podcast of people with babies.
We got babies. We got lots of babies and no pensions.
Lots of babies, no pensions. Please enjoy these words from our sponsors.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back. Moving on. Let's talk about what happens after the whole Mahone and Polk thing. So we see Bodhi waking up after getting brutalized by Kima and Carve and basically every cop who was there at the pit that day. He wakes up in a juvenile detention facility looks around.
He did throw the first punch, to be fair.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get why the cops did it because cops do that. If you hit a cop,
no, I think that's
cops
an acceptable
turn into a gang.
Yeah,
a gang.
I think that's an acceptable beatdown, personally.
No, I don't think so. I think in general, the job of the cop is not to do
in an ideal
gang style
world,
beatdowns on anyone.
In an ideal world, but you know what? Like that's just the rule of life. If you throw a punch at someone, and you might get beat down afterwards. That's
oh,
just,
for sure.
That's just
Yeah, no, I mean, everyone who's in the gang life is like, yeah, no, that's normal.
Yeah.
Like, for sure, they're like, no, I know the rules. But what I'm saying is that should be against the rules, in my opinion.
Sure. Well, he should get 66% pension after that.
100%. See, I agree with that.
Does Avon Barksdale do a pension?
I think so. He definitely very generous with his pension.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, no, they've got... That's the thing about the Barksdale organization. Strong union. But yeah, so he wakes up. He looks like trash. And he asks if there's anyone from West Side over there. And it's all DC boys, which I assume is like scary.
I think what they're doing here, I mean, to explain the art in this, I think what they're doing here is like the traditional view of these like gang kids on the corners that they're like tough guys and they're not scared of anything. But like which is partly true, but like the flip side is that they're extremely provincial, and you see this like throughout the show. Like these guys, they know their own neighborhood and literally nothing else. So of course they're like terrified of the idea of being outside of their neighborhood, because like that's the one thing that they know really well.
True.
And so here he is, like with a bunch of DC boys, which he doesn't want to be.
None of them look scary though. They just happen to be from a bigger city.
Yeah,
they're from a bigger city, and you know, they're just like young sad boys in a juvenile detention facility. But I think for him, he's like, oh, if I don't know anybody here, then I'm a target. Because if these guys all know each other and I'm a stranger, then I'm probably in trouble. So he escapes Boys Village, the juvie facility, by just grabbing a bucket and a mop.
I like that, because it's like you think the mop is going to be incorporated into some sort of clever scheme, but he just sort of like walks 5 feet to the left and then looks around and he's like, and walks out an open door.
Yeah.
The mop did not need to be there.
No, it didn't.
No one was paying attention to him at all.
And no, he could have just walked. You realize that as you're like, he's walking out and no one gives him it was a just-in-case type thing, you know, but he was like, no, he could have just walked out, apparently.
Yeah, it's sort of like the most boring version of the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, which I love. I love the idea that, you know, he's...
Here, Tim Robbins, take this mop.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
That day, Andy Dufresne pretended to be a janitor, and he escaped Shawshank. It was real easy.
I don't know what those two French ladies were singing about. Could have been mops. Some say it was. I don't know why I did Morgan Freeman as like a 30s radio announcer, but yeah, I did.
Well it's better to do it in a black voice, okay?
Yeah. No, we've decided if we're going to do a black voice, we're instead going to do some sort of like Cajun alligator voice. That's what we have decided, or at least that's what I'm doing. So as you know, like Bodie is kind of the character who's like the smart ass pawn, you know? He's the one who coined that phrase, and I love that his version of being a smart-ass pawn is just grabbing a bucket and a mop and walking.
He was pretty smart in retrospect. He got out of there.
No, it worked. He is a smart-ass pawn.
The question about that I have is, like, he escaped from a juvenile detention facility, but, like, if you're the cop assigned with trying to figure out where Bodie is, it's got to be pretty easy. Like, he goes to the pit. That's where he works. Like, you know where he works. You could just show up there the next day.
That's true. You do know where his job is.
Or you go to his mom's house or something.
Yeah.
Well, right. So, first, Herc and Carve do go up to...
Which, that's another great commentary. Like, Herc and Carve should... Like, they've been staking out his workplace for, like, the last... 2 weeks. Like, they should know exactly where to find him, but they are, you know, it's like when you put a beaver anywhere, he's gonna make a dam, because that's just what beavers do. Like, what cops do is they look on the sheet and they're like, last known address, you gotta go there, even though it makes no sense in this context.
They're not smart. They're bad cops.
He's a teen boy. He's home doing his homework, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
No, he's stealing drugs on the street.
they check the school and then they check the library.
Malt shop and he wasn't there.
Yeah.
They go to his mom's house and they have this sort of moment where they're like banging on the door, like, open the fucking door, you know, and they go upstairs and they're talking shit on the house. It's really unnecessarily mean to Bodie's grandma and her house making skills. And then Herc has like this moment of reflection with Bodie's mom.
I'm sorry for cursing at the door. I mean, I couldn't see that it was only you.
Would you like to sit down? Preston came to me when my daughter died. He was 4 years old.
No, I'm sorry, ma'am. And I'm sorry for the way we came through here. If Preston comes past, give him this and tell him we need to talk, Okay.
It's sort of like in Schindler's List when Ralph Fiennes has that that interlude.
I pardon you.
Yeah.
This is like this is Herc's "I pardon you" sequence.
Yes.
The one thing that I don't know why, and maybe I've just like created this in my mind, but like after Herc gives Grandma his card and leaves, like that's all there is. Like in my mind, like I'm filling in this part where she like looks at the card and just like tosses it over her shoulder because obviously she's not going to call fucking Herc. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have that moment. I don't know if it was just implied with a single look and then I sort of filled in the blanks in my mind, or
it's called art, dude.
Yeah,
it's called art, first of all. But also there's a lot of like inferences that I think would be made that were made at least by me when I initially watched the show. And again, if this were another show, I actually do think they would have shown her throwing it out. And if this were another show, this would be the moment where Herc starts changing.
Yeah.
And learning that in order to do really good police work, you do have to get to know the neighborhood. You got to know the hood that you work in, and you have to be friends, or at the very least, you have to be acquainted with the people who you're going to someday hope to get information from. But that's not at all what happens. He accidentally does good police work in this one instance and then goes right back to being a shitty cop for the rest of the series. And yeah. I think that's that to me, that's what makes the show amazing, is he learns nothing from this. He just at one point decides, well, I kind of feel bad for like busting into a little old lady's house.
He has a moment. He has a moment swearing. Where he could have learned to be better, but he didn't, because people usually don't.
Yes, exactly. And that's an important thing to know. Meanwhile, back at the pit where Bodhi obviously would be, he shows back up and he's like bragging about escaping Boy's village. And, you know, he's saying, you know, it's just like, well, sir, I escaped Boy's village. Yeah. You know, cause it's maybe I won't do the alligator voice.
Willem Dafoe from Wild at Heart.
I just don't want to do a black disgusting. Accent.
How about just do your normal voice?
No, it has to be a voice.
It's gotta be silly. It's gotta be a bit.
He's a voice comic. Leave him alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So he shows up. He's like, oh, hello, love. Oh, I'm back from Boy's Village, yeah? Oh, I'm around. And he's like, he's bragging.
He's bragging, and being a shitty boss cannot congratulate one of his underlings for, you know, successfully escaping juvenile hall and coming back to work. Like, that's what a good manager, I feel like, would do in this situation. But instead, D just takes this opportunity to kind of big time him, which...
Well, he's bragging. There's a lot of, like, braggadocio and saying, man, the Boy's Village can't hold me.
Man, Boy's Village ain't shit. It can't hold me. What you laughing at? What's so funny? You was me, your ass still be down there.
You ever seen a city jail, nigga? You ever caught a body?
Yeah, you got the one.
Yeah, the one you know about, man. Y'all little motherfuckers need to ask around.
It's like, it's a village. It's not a jail.
Yeah, it's not man's village. I think he starts big-timing him because he's saying, like, Bodhi just says, well, your ass would still be there if it had been you. And then at that point he feels threatened, and that's when he tells the story.
So there was this little shorty who used to stay out there. This was a shorty my uncle was messing with. So, you know, they was going on at it for a little while till she find out that my uncle got another little shorty, ran away. So she goes off the hook and shit, talking about she gonna call the police, start talking about shit she ain't supposed to know about.
Oh shit.
Yeah, you know it. So they rolled me out past her crib. So I pulled out the piece. I start tapping with the back of it on the window. Tap, tap, tap. That's what she heard, yo. Sure enough, she comes out. She's naked and shit. I don't know why the fuck, but she turns on the light. And you know, when she does that, and it's light on the inside, she can't see shit on the outside.
Dang. She naked.
It's the important thing to remember.
I really love, everything. Everything Poot says in the scene is so horny, and I love him.
I mean, he's, if you're 14 and hearing that story, or 15 or whatever Poot is, like, that's the part you're going to focus on. You're like, I don't know what you just said, but you said someone was naked, and that's what I'm picturing.
Yes. It's just like this horrifying story about murdering a woman in cold blood who is wearing a robe and is naked under it.
Tap, tap, tap is the sound of Poot's boner against the window.
Tap,
Damn.
We also find out that D has a lot of creep to him, and that's why Avon picked him for doing this crime.
Yeah, certainly has nothing to do with you know, them being related or anything. But the scene ends with this great line.
Yo, D, if she was all that, why didn't you fuck her first?
Nigga, you sick. Just shut up.
What?
I'm
just
saying.
Seriously wrong. the little conversation they have, Wallace is like, why are you disgusting? Why are you like this? Can't you just hear a story and have empathy and not immediately get horny for a naked lady? But you gotta give it to Poot. He has priorities.
Hey.
If
you can dehumanize a person to kill them, you can dehumanize him to fuck them too.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. It's all, you know, it's all a spectrum of dehumanization and violence. This murder, this very specific murder that D is talking about, actually ends up being the murder that is looked into by Bunk and McNulty later. So earlier in the episode, Jay tells Jimmy that there's a file on an open murder, and there's a D in the file, meaning like there's a witness who puts someone named D at the scene or around the scene,
which
or is the last person.
Which make a ton of sense, because like if D just showed up outside her window, how would they know? How would any of her friends know who the hell D is?
Well, D was the last person that she saw. They like the last person that friends saw her with. So
feels like a stretch, but I get it.
Well, the whole thing is a stretch.
Huge stretch.
And at this point, it's clear that like Jay Landsman is just doing this, I think, because he's like, while you guys are doing this bullshit detail, I have this open murder and I need someone to check it out, and hey, there's a little bit of a, hey, maybe there's a connection. He's trying to basically shoehorn one of his open cases into this bullshit detail. And he doesn't know that actually he ends up being accidentally correct. And Jay has a very interesting kind of like storyline in this, in which like his main purpose in this episode seems to be to defend Jimmy McNulty. To Rawls, and he has that great fucking scene.
He's somehow a bad boss and a really good boss at the same time.
Yeah. He's like,
he's recognizing the strengths of Jimmy McNulty, even though McNulty's clearly like sort of an asshole, but he's
Hold
also,
guys.
Sorry, go ahead.
I have to disagree with you guys.
Oh, okay.
The idea that Jay likes McNulty is false. Completely false.
Oh, I agree with
all
that.
All he wants is for McNulty to not be on the detail anymore so he can clear the cases off the board.
Right, but that still involves him recognizing the talent of an underling. Like, he doesn't necessarily like him, but he does, like, recognize that that McNulty's really good at certain things, which is a lot for a boss. I feel like
I think a boss will do their best to deny any of their underlings are good at anything, especially the cops. So I give him credit for knowing that Jimmy is good, but not credit enough to be like, he doesn't care about like general police work.
Oh,
like,
no, he's doing it for entirely selfish reasons.
Yeah, he's doing it for the stats. He wants to get more clearances.
Yeah, that's all he cares about. And
yes.
So he does this elaborate fucking monologue in front of what's his face?
Rawls. Yeah.
Last night, I'm at home. I'm sitting up buck naked. And I got one hand wrapped around a cold domestic beer and the other wrapped around my magnificent flaccid 4 1/2-inch wonder. And I am trying with all my might to remember what Layla Kaufman's nipples looked like when her bathing top slipped off at the Hillendale pool swim party. When all of a fucking sudden, out of fucking nowhere, fucking detective fucking Jimmy McNulty pops into my head.
I was jacking off.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. To my boss, I'm going to tell him that I was jacking off, because I think he'll find it funny that I was drinking a beer and masturbating at the same time. Yes. And thinking about a child, essentially. I have a fantasy about this girl from high school who is a minor. Anyway, you know what ruined that beautiful moment? Jimmy McNulty.
Yeah.
I love
that
this
cock. That cock tease, son of a bitch.
I love this character because it's like the least, easily the least believable character in the show, which is basically
the most,
like, what if the most
David Simon character?
What if the most theaters-y theater kid became like the head of the homicide squad in the Baltimore Police Department, which is just a wild thought. And that, and Delaney, whatever his name is, Delaney Williams is such a goddamn good actor that he pulls off David Simon's most theatrical monologues consistently.
Yeah, it's filled with David Simonisms, like just the way he describes jacking off, the way he fucking describes what he's masturbating to, the first and last name of the minor he's remembering, like,
yeah, and then like it just
as if Rawls, did they go to the same school? Do they know this little Jewish girl? Yeah.
Rawls is just like entertaining this disgusting story
about
this slovenly man masturbating after work.
Yeah.
And there's only one point where he recognizes that this is inappropriate. He says, "Where are you going with this?"
Yeah.
He's at least curious enough to know how it ends.
Right. I mean,
he only asked that when he realizes that this was all just an elaborate wind-up for a defense of Jimmy McNulty. That's when he's really offended.
Yeah.
McNulty. First of all, it's not Jimmy's fault.
No?
No. Jimmy is an addict, sir.
What's he addicted to?
Himself. The guy, he has come to believe that he is always the smartest fuck in the room. Christ. It must have been months, even. He was the smartest fuck in the fucking room.
What's your point, Jay?
My point is, he can't help it. It makes him an asshole. I know, but it's also what makes him good police.
There's also like a meta level to this scene because this is all of this entire like monologue is David Simon's observations about the real Detective Landsman that he like worked with in the homicide. Like this was his entire take on this homicide detective, which is that, you know, he's driven by trying to prove that he's always the smartest person in the room, and he's like put that in the mouth of a character that he's named after that guy, and is using it to describe like his other creation, McNulty, which is, I don't know. It's very transparent in the way that it's constructed, and but it's just so beautifully written and acted that it totally works.
It's a level of, I think, of, I don't know, character, I guess you would call it exposition, that I think on most shows I would find, like, if it wasn't pulled off correctly, it would be very annoying. Mm-hmm. It would be like, listen, this is a cop, he's hard-boiled, but he's doing his damn best. Yeah, he's a drunk. Like any other show, again, would fuck this up. But instead, it just ends up being, I mean, the windup is necessary. I needed to hear him talk about jacking off to an imaginary, to a child from his youth, you know?
It's so unabashedly like novelistic the way it's written. But I think because he has that character embrace it and sort of he's almost doing like this self-parody in the scene. Like he knows he's being annoying and he's doing it deliberately, that it's easier to buy in somehow.
I think he's also trying to be chummy with Rawls a little bit, where it's like, all right, you know, I know I'm gonna do this thing that is gonna be annoying because you don't want to hear about McNulty, but I desperately need him back so that he can clear cases for me because I'm lazy. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to come in and I'm going to tell you a story like we're at the bar and we're hanging out.
Right. Yes.
And that's 100%. Cool, right? Like that's what we talk about at the bar. We'll have shots of whiskey and then we'll talk about various pathetic moments in our sad little lives. And everybody will laugh.
I love the idea of like cops being that real with each other, where not only are they talking about masturbating, but he's talking about barely being able to get it up and not actually almost, he said, close to being engorged.
My massive 4-inch cock.
And I think going back to Entourage, this is why I never liked Entourage, because Entourage was supposed to be this sort of warts and all depiction of male friendship, but they never once got like gross with each other. It's always like one person would give maybe like a tiny crumb of this monologue, and then the other characters in the scene would be like, oh, gross, bro. And it's like in real life, no, he would go for it just the same way that Lansman did.
Yeah, I can imagine Jay going into Rawls' office and being like, so, boss, here's what cum tastes like. Just describing in great detail the flavor and consistency of a man's ejaculate.
Oh, meanwhile, you couldn't imagine like Turtle going into Rawls' office.
Johnny Drama. Just being,
Johnny Drama going
Never tasted cum like that before, let me tell you.
Here's the thing, Vinny. I'm not gay at all. No, you know I'm not gay.
I mean, we've all tried a little bit of cum. Am I right or am I right? Hey.
Not for nothing.
Gabagool?
I saw the print. I saw the outline in his sweatpants, and I got to tell you, my mouth watered a little bit.
Yeah,
great sweatpants. You know what they do to a man's cock? Oh, it's great.
Yeah. Oh, anyways, the wonderful thing is that this scene ends with Rawls being like, "All right, you've convinced me. Tell him to wrap up that bullshit detail." Which is like, if you're following the show, you're like, "No, no, no, wait."
Yeah.
No, he need to be on the detail. That's why I'm. When's the wire gonna happen?
He calls them natural police, which I feel like, you know, whatever job you do. If your boss calls you natural, whatever your job version of natural police is, you're going to take that as such a high compliment that you'd feel okay doing a shit job for a little longer.
Yeah.
Or you end up being stuck in that job forever because you're too good at it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's of course. Like Jay being the middle manager and Rawls being the like the top guy, essentially.
It's the old Oscar thing where, you know, Louis B. Mayer figured out that, you know, you just pin enough baubles and trinkets on them and they'll keep working for your non-union shit wages.
Yep.
But speaking of natural police, so the scene after this wraps up the entire, you know, tap, 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 fuck, fuck, fuck. The whole punch in the pit storyline is, of course, the great fuck, fuck, fuck scene. And we've already discussed that legendary scene. But at the beginning of that scene, Bunk is actually explaining to McNulty that Lester is also natural police. And I think that leads us into the rest of this episode. The detail does exhaustion. Exhaustion is one of the prerequisites to getting a wire or getting a clone of a pager. You basically need to show to a judge that you have tried every other thing possible in order to, you know, gather information on a case and nothing has worked. So then they can sign off on it. And we start off with Kima and McNulty. They're at the court trying to convince a convict, one of the guys who got caught in the buy bust thing, the raid earlier, trying to convince him to flip. And he basically would rather take the years than flip on Avon Barksdale. And I have a clip of that.
Tell us some stories. Might could be somebody else's turn.
Stories.
Avon Barksdale. Know the name?
Every motherfucker up in them towers know the name.
What's your name, man?
All right, I take the years.
He would rather take the years than flip on any of the people in his crew. Because he's not stupid. And getting people to flip seems to be what everyone thinks they're going to do correctly. When Herc and Carve are going up to Boys Town or Boys Village to pick up Bodhi, Carve has this entire fantasy of how he's going to get Bodhi to flip.
Imagine we jack him up, toss him into a small room, and tell him that Detective Mahone is near dead from the sucker punch. It's like, no shit. Drunk old fuck suddenly slipped into a coma. And we've been ordered to come down here, rip off his scrotum, put it in a jar, and drive it back to Baltimore so it can sit with the fucking bowling trophies behind the bar at the FOP Lodge. Right? After which, fuck nuts stops whimpering long enough to just start giving people up. Whoever. Little prick turns on everybody, and we break the case wide open.
Cool.
Cool, which I just love.
Tell me about the rabbits, Carve.
Yeah. So yeah, so Kima and Bubs later on, they're creeping around, and Bubs is telling Kima about Omar. Omar and how he's related to a guy named No Heart Anthony. And No Heart Anthony is someone that Kima's never heard of, and McNulty ends up knowing everything about.
You ever heard of No Heart Anthony?
Who, Anthony Little? 1058 Argyle Apartment 16J. He's up in Hagerstown on a robbery bit. What about him?
My man.
Fuck y'all.
The relationship between Kima and McNulty in this episode I find kind of interesting, because you see kind of like McNulty, his love life is fucked up. Is like he's divorced, his wife hates him, he hates his wife, shit is going bad, but he's really good police. Like, he knows everything about the neighborhood that he polices in. He knows not only who No Heart Anthony is, but he knows his fucking home address and where he's currently in prison. Meanwhile, Kima doesn't know any of the things about the people that she polices on a daily basis, but she has this home life that is like loving. She has this loving wife, and she's studying for the bar or something like that. And, you know, you see that she is like, you're not sure who wants whose life in this case. Like, does Kima want to be McNulty? Does McNulty want to be Kima?
Yeah, there's a little envy going both ways.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, I think so. It's I like seeing McNulty actually being the smartest one in the room. But
especially when you can tell that like the reason he knows No Heart Anthony's home address and where he's at in prison is because that's filling brain space where like his child's birthday and his anniversaries should probably go.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, it's the dates of various soccer matches of his children, when he's supposed to be somewhere, what time the court date is for the separation agreement. But yeah, that's he doesn't have space for that, but he does know exactly where every single person he's put away is currently living. Because that's what he cares about.
Also,
at the end of
That's what he cares about at the end of the day. So yeah, so McNulty takes Bubbles, his snitch, to his son's soccer game. And I know it's like not the point of the scene at all, but I really do like the slice. Like, you really get a sense of how fucking cold it is at this soccer game, because every kid is playing soccer and they're all wearing like turtlenecks and sweatpants, and I don't know if that's just like normal if you grow up on the East Coast, but watching that, I'm like, god damn, that looks terrible. They're playing
Bubbles
soccer out
in
the freezing ass
in
cold.
His pants.
Yeah,
he puts his hands in his pants while he's waiting.
Yeah,
like, I don't think you can do that within 50 feet of a child.
Yeah. Especially when you got like track marks on your arms and like sores on your face.
Oh god, poor Bubbles didn't even get a handshake.
I know. I felt bad, but also though, have you been put in that situation before? It's hard to be. I've done it where I've like someone who is clearly homeless and currently IV drug user puts their hand up for a handshake. And I've just been like, oh, God. It is gross when you shake someone's hand who's like clearly, a homeless drug addict. It is a thing. You know, I felt bad. I felt awful for him. But it was also like, yeah, that's hard. That's hard to. Then again, I did shake the hand. So, you know, I'm a good person, but I didn't want to. So I'm a bad person. So Omar, we finally get to see him making out with a dude in this episode, which is really nice. There's the amazing scene with Omar in this is that Omar and his boyfriend and their third guy are sitting on the stoop counting their money, and Omar at one point like gives some free heroin to like this junkie mother because he's a good guy. He's a little bit of like a Robin Hood of the hood. And he's making out with his boyfriend. And at one point he like puts his hand on the third guy and goes like, hey, you're going to come hang out, or basically invites him over. and the guy is visibly uncomfortable with homosexuality. Like, he's clearly homophobic, but he's also like, you know, I don't know, I got a pretty good job here.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like very fun to watch the very subtle expression of disgust from someone who is like ostensibly their business partner. But
yeah, I think what you do is gross, but I'm also deathly afraid of you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I don't want to cross you, and also we seem to be doing pretty all right money wise. You know, that's what they say about capitalism, is it solves all social issues. Mm-hmm.
Makes
so far it has, yeah.
Some strange bedfellows, that's for sure.
Yes. Meanwhile, for as subtle as his, you know, the friend is, the third guy is, Avon is straight up homophobic. And Avon's scene in this episode is fucking fantastic as he's trying to explain what he wants done to Omar. And I have a clip.
You know how the cracker motherfuckers do when they kill a deer? Or like when they go out killing animals and whatnot? Got them on the front of the truck, tied up, stretched out, so everybody could see it. I want that motherfucker on display. You tell him it's $1,000 on the bucks, and it's a deuce on Omar.
Yeah, Bird's on it. Savino, too. You know, Bird jailed with Omar down the cut, right? He said he all faggot.
A faggot?
Mm-hmm. Fuck out of here. Said he had a whole stable of boys down in Jessup. This punk motherfucker got even less use for pussy now that he home.
So he got a lot of heart for a cocksucker, huh?
Yo. We're doubling down on Sweet Lips.
Sweet Lips is really a great nickname.
Yeah, he just tossed that off. Like,
yeah. Yeah,
is that what your wife calls you, Matt?
Yeah, that is, but, you know, that's...
Between me and my bride.
Another interesting aspect of this scene, which is what I focus on every time that I rewatch The Wire, is just that Wood Harris is authentically an athlete in a way that actors basically never are. And like that whole scene, all I'm staring at is how goddamn big his hands are. Like, he's like casually palming
the ball. Yeah,
he casually palms that ball like it's a fucking baseball. And
is that him dunking for real at the end of the scene?
I'm pretty sure. So he played basketball at NIU.
There it is.
And was also a theater major. His older brother's also an actor and was like a football player. His older brother, I don't know what I could say that you would remember him from, but he is definitely a face that you would know. He's like the bald cop dude that's in every cop show. But yeah, like all I can see in that scene is Wood Harris being like authentically a basketball player, and I'm always curious why he doesn't get more work, just because he fills a niche that most actors can't, and he's also a really good actor.
There's like a handful, like I don't see Andre Royo doing as much as I think I would like to, and he's probably the best actor on the show.
Yeah.
Can I make a point? Maybe that it's possible that there are not enough roles in Hollywood for black actors.
I don't think that's it.
That could be it. I also wonder
impossible.
If Wood Harris is just too tall. Like, you can't have a guy that's like 6'3" around most actors, because you can tell how tall they actually are.
Meanwhile, James Cromwell's out here being the only 6'6" actor to exist.
Yeah.
Taking all the tall guy jobs, taking all the old guy. It's bullshit, dude. It's, again, a part of the verisimilitude of the show. Like,
they put that dunk in there had nothing to do with the scene. They just put that in there because they're like, check this dude out. He can actually dunk.
And you know what they didn't show? They didn't show Idris Elba playing at all. Because that fool was completely unnatural. He's British. He's like, him with a cricket bat, he would kill it. But no, not with a basketball.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because I have not watched the show in maybe 7, 8, 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I've seen Idris Elba in his natural accent, the less believable he becomes.
I know.
Every time I watch the show.
I know.
It's an awful accent. He sounds horrible.
It's crazy because, like, the first few times I watched the show, I was like, oh, he's one of my favorite characters. He's one of the best actors on the show. And I actually still believe he's one of the best actors on the show without being able to master the accent. But now that I've gotten a taste for what a Baltimore accent would sound like, or at least a regionally East Coast accent, you realize Idris Elba is doing a generic black gangster accent, and it kind of, it paints the performance a little bit as like, oh, yeah. That's kind of, it's not as good.
I also, it's the one thing that takes you out of the show.
I also like, think
oh,
that,
he's
yeah.
not it. He's not it. He's not doing it right.
I also yeah. think his accent, his American accent got worse after the show. I think mm-hmm. that might be part of it. I don't know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, but here's the thing. This is the show that made him a star.
Yeah.
And so he is, I think, objectively great as Stringer Bell. It's such a fucking great written character, and he acts great. And the accents on this show, I think, are just kind of all over the place when it comes to both McNulty and Stringer. And also fucking Carchetti. When Littlefinger shows up in season 3 and is like, you have, like, I watched that originally. I was like, oh, that's amazing. And now I watch it and I go, like, what accent is he doing?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I think it almost benefits the show a little bit to have a lot of British actors who are not good at accents because of the fact that it made me, as someone watching it, going like, maybe people just talk weird mm-hmm. in Baltimore.
Well, they do.
And exactly.
So just not weird really in wrong. That way, yeah.
Right. It works. So just to round out the episode, basically, Burrell tries to get everything shut down with those buy busts, and the judge says, nah, fuck yourself. You got to keep going. Then the judge calls McNulty, and he brags to McNulty that he told Burrell to keep working the case, which McNulty kind of just is like, okay. And like, he takes it weird. There's something about McNulty not being able to say thank you that starts pissing me off.
Well, because he can't say thank you because, like, the judge is... He thinks he's helping McNulty, but he's really just fucking his shit up more.
Right. He's hurting McNulty's career prospects. He knows that he's tanking his career. You know, Burrell is going to take revenge, or Rawls is. Meanwhile, we get to the big scene with Kima and McNulty and Freeman all team up together to try to convince Daniels to get a fucking pager clone. And this is the first time we actually see what the fuck Freeman has been doing the last couple of episodes. It turns out that Freeman was able to get a phone number for a pager for D specifically, for D'Angelo Barksdale. He calls it earlier in a scene, and then he sees that, yes, he got the right pager number.
We got most of the exhaustion.
I'm exhausted. Just listen to this shit.
Good. Exhaustion is a legal requirement for using electronic intercepts.
See, we try to show a judge we can't make the case by following these guys, and we can't. How can we keep on any of them when they go up in those towers?
But you gotta show you tried.
Do we have a pager number?
This is written on the stash house wall with the letter D next to it.
Is that D'Angelo? Did you check it?
It's him.
Amazing you other dumb fucks missed that.
So he takes him out for a drink, and we finally learn Freeman's story. Freeman used to be a good cop, but he's been in the pawn shop unit for 13 years and 4 months.
How long you been in the pawn shop unit?
13 years and 4 months.
13 years?
And 4 months.
Why'd you ask out of homicide?
Well, no ask about it.
You got the boot?
Uh-huh.
What'd you do to piss him off?
Police work.
I think I need to buy you a drink.
Just one?
And the reason that he was in the pawn shop unit is because he basically didn't listen to what his superior officer said and didn't let a particular suspect go, I believe. There was
yeah.
Turned out he was the son of one of the big editors over the News American. The deputy, who I guess is in a favor-doing mood, sends word down to the major I'm supposed to make the case without defense.
So he's doing this for what? Have some newspaper guy in his pocket?
Yeah, I guess so.
So what did you do?
What do you think I did? I charged him with receiving, then had his ass testify.
Well, you could have made the case without him, just on the prints and the statements.
Probably. Yep.
Why didn't you?
Why? Why are you fucking up yourself chasing Avon Barksdale?
For the same reason. Because fuck the bosses, is what I assume. And I think it's just that both of them are just stubborn enough and just smart enough to be like, if I don't let this case play out the way I want it to play out, then no one will know that I was really, really smart. And I will sacrifice my career in order to show people that I don't give a fuck about the editor of some newspaper.
Yeah.
Like oppositional defiance disorder.
Yes.
Well, that's why some people get into policing in the first place.
Yeah, it's true.
It's because now they have power.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And in their cases, they're using their power less to just be bullies of people below them and more so to be bullies for people above them. They're punching up. Which,
yeah, like a good comic would.
Like
right?
All good comics do. Always punch up. Always punch at power. I mean, that is essentially what they do. But
that's
they
what
also
Bodhi did too.
That's right. So mm-hmm. Bodhi was also punching up.
That's what Marlo Stanfield did too.
That's right. That
always
is true.
Always punching up, you know.
Always punching up.
Yvonne
that's
was
what
up here and he went wham and took his
yeah.
shit.
Yeah, exactly, dude. Punch up. That's the lesson from Pod Yourself The Wire. And then in the final scene, McNulty visits Kima, Kima's home while he's drunk as fuck. And he wants to thank Kima, but also I think he wants to fuck. I think he thinks.
I don't think he knows the difference between those two.
I don't think he knows either. I think you're right.
Does he
right.
not know that she is in a committed same-sex relationship?
I mean, he knows that she's gay, yep. but he also knows that he is hot.
Yeah.
Okay, so you think that he believes that he can make her not gay?
Yes.
I think he doesn't know the difference between gratitude towards a woman and wanting to fuck. I don't know.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. He's dumb. Yeah,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
He dumb.
No, he's not dumb. He's just Irish. The Irish, genetically.
I love the casual racism against Irish people on this show. We start with redheads and just burying the fuck out of them. And it's like, oh, you know what Irish people love to do? Drink. And then get into fights. And then also they don't know how sex works.
They don't know exactly. how to not commit adultery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't know how to not make Jesus cry.
Good Lord.
Good Lord. You've got to convert the lesbians by having sex with them.
Let's throw another shrimp on the Barbie. Am I right, fellas? That's what they say over there.
I'm an alligator from the South.
You call that a knife? This is a knife.
Oh, get in the chopper. All right. Well, that is how the episode ends. And it's a great episode. Do we have a favorite scene, least favorite scene, or a scene that I forgot to cover? Vince?
I mean, I loved almost every scene. The one thing that I didn't like is, and this is just a consistent problem, is I can't figure out what the hell accent Polk is trying to do. He seems like he's trying to be Irish sometimes and then other yeah. times not, and I'm confused by it.
It is like he is doing an Irish accent, which I think is strange.
Oh, Patrick,
also,
it'd be so great if we could be retired yeah. together.
What am I going to do now, Patrick?
I'll break my fucking neck.
Yeah, I'll break my fucking neck during that. Yeah, I don't understand why he has that accent, but...
Because they didn't know what the fuck to do or how to figure out how a Baltimore accent sounds.
I think you're right.
Baltimore
that's 100%
accents
it.
Are unintelligible. That and Pittsburgh yeah. accents are like not English. Right. So you can't do them for real on TV.
Right. They're so specific that no one can really mimic it. And so therefore, everyone's just like, go buck wild. Everyone do a weird one.
Yeah.
Which I think yeah. it ends up working well for the show.
It's like in a Roman movie or TV show. And it's like, what did Roman people sound like? I don't know.
British
people? who fucking cares, right?
I do love that when they're just like... You know, we need people to sound, you know, like imperial. Well, let's do British. And it's yeah. like, come on, let's be real. Oh. They would have an American accent.
They'd sound just like Tom Cruise.
Exactly. Dave, do you have a favorite scene, least favorite scene, or a scene we did not talk about?
I mean, I just love Jay talking about jacking off. For him to go into his boss's office and talk about cranking his hog while he's drinking a beer on the other hand. I don't know if you guys have ever tried that before.
Mm.
It's a lot harder than it sounds.
Yeah. It sounds difficult. I yeah. feel like it's like trying to pat yourself on the head and rub your tummy
belly.
At the same time and then switch. You just start trying
you start
to drink
jacking
your dick.
Off the beer.
And trying to drink your dick. so stupid. If I had to grade this episode, I'd probably give it a solid B+. Vince, what would you give this episode?
The solidest B+.
Okay. Dave Schilling, what would you give this episode?
I'm going to go A-. I think it's actually a really, really stellar episode of The Wire. I think it's one of the best episodes of TV that they ever did, just in terms of like making it accessible.
Yeah.
It's the first season and it's the first episode that really feels like the show.
So solid B+ episode of The Wire and a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself The Wire. Dave Schilling, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. I can't wait to come back for season 2.
I can't wait as well. It's going to be great. We're going to talk about the docs. That'll be a lot of fun. Where can people find you on the internet?
At Dave_Schilling is my Twitter handle.
Yes.
And that's it.
And what about, did you, Instagram? You want?
Yeah, right. My Instagram is at DW Schilling. If you really want to see photos of my clothes, I guess some people do. Some people do. It's fine.
You've that's got great fashion sense.
I know.
Well, check him out on all of the platforms and follow him. Dave, thank you so much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Patreon.com/Frotcast for all of the bonus episodes. Also, the $8 tier. Hi, Sammy. Also, the $8 tier will get you a shout out on Pod Yourself The Wire. Vince, it is time. We are now live, up and running, and people have sent in their $8 patron fucking subscription. Hell so yeah. I have some names. Of course, we're not going to get to all of them. We're not going to get to all of them this week, but your name will be read out. We promise you. But, you know, right now Vince is wrestling with a baby. There's no way we're going to get through all of them. So, Vince, gangster names. First,
okay.
Joshua Westlund.
Oh, we call this guy the Iron Lund.
I love it. That's good.
Because he's always, you know, he's always using his inhaler. Mm-hmm. He's got asthma pretty bad. Yeah, Iron Lund. Yeah. He lives in an Iron Lund.
I like it. And also feel free to consider like rap names like that start with Lil or Young, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay, so next we have Kyle S. Bolini.
Oh, we call this guy Red Sauce.
Okay, all right. All right, it's a gangster. I thought, fine.
Look, you don't think he's going to get nicknamed Red Sauce in the hood? You don't know nothing about the hood.
That's true.
Yeah.
Is he Bellini, so I appreciate it. Next, Howard Webster. Young Dictionary.
We call this guy Lil Man.
Little man, okay.
Yeah, that's what I would call a guy named Webster, because the TV show with Webster on it, he was little.
Okay, I like it. Okay, now I do get it. All right,
yep.
Next, AJ Guzman,
The Goose.
All right, you don't want to go with like Lil Goose, Young Goose. Try to mix it up a little bit.
Why are you micromanaging my nicknames?
You're right.
No one said Lil Stinkum or like Young Weebay. That's just what their nicknames were, you know?
That's true. You're not wrong. I'm going to shut up. Kyle Herman.
We call this guy Lil Herm.
Now you're doing. Okay. Next, Greg Miller.
Hold up. We call this guy G-Mill.
Okay, very good.
Mm-hmm. That's next, creative. He's never heard that before.
I mean, maybe not. Next, Dominic Frezza.
Fresno.
All right, Fresno. Hell yeah. Luis Cardenas.
I don't think it's Cardenas, dude. That's not how you pronounce that one.
Well, I re-pronounce. Is it Cardenas?
Yeah. We call that guy Motor City.
Okay, love it.
Yeah.
Next is Justin. I remember this guy. I always have to have trouble with his name. Very Chochoni on me.
We call that guy Penthouse because he reminds me of Bob Guccione.
Okay, I love it.
Yeah.
Four more left. Andrew Streeter.
Hold up. Yeah. We call this guy Elm Street because he's a nightmare to work with.
Oh, I love it. Next is Johnny Tremblay.
We call this guy Freddy Cat.
Because he always be Tremblaying.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. Justin Fenton.
Yeah. We call that guy Test Strip because, you know, you need to put
fentanyl
one.
Strip. Uh-huh. I got you, dude. And last, we have Stephen Cottrell.
Cut. We call this guy Cuddy. Dude, obviously. We call him
obviously.
Cuddy.
Or Cottrell. I don't know. Could be that Cody or Cuddy. Either one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And that is your $8 tier for this week. Once again, patreon.com/frogcast. $8 tier. We'll get you a shout out. Please join us. Obviously, you hear babies. More babies coming soon. Help, 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 help. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415, I almost gave our phone number a nickname. 415-275-0030.
All right, everybody. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Wires. The Wire. Yeah. Wire Podcast. The world's only Wire Podcast. Yeah, bitch, this is a show about The Wire. And it's also about putting out some fires. It's about war on drugs and the war on terror. It's about lots of things, but it's also about cool guys who sell drugs to their friends and their thugs. And everybody's seeing all the things going on, and no one's doing nothing, and no one's ever gonna win, and the war won't end till everyone tries heroin. It's about schools and people who work at the docks and people who teach in schools and the newspaper guys at the end, and also about drug dealers and also about drug users and also about McNulty getting a divorce from his wife. About what Obama likes, it either means that he has good taste or it means that he watched the show and decided to not do anything when he had the power to change things. But whatever, bruh, that's fine. I wouldn't have done it neither. Probably I'd be too scared to do it. David Simon, come on the show.
Hey, so I ran out of songs from various Baltimore bands that I like because I only really know three. So now I'm just doing songs from 2002. 2002, guys.
Homer kisses his boy Brandon, hooks a fiend up with some hair on, rubs the shoulder of his friend John. Omar's telling him job well done. Belly turns and walks away from him, kinda weirded out by Case. Mahone in the ER laid up, Kissy fractured his vertebra. That joke did him a favor, puts in his retirement papers. Gonna leave with 2/3 pay, won't he? Poker said he's gonna. Cases, Deidre Cresson, apartment on the ground floor, got shot right through her window.
from Boys Village. Carvin Hurt cuss out his grandma. Bodie hitchhike steals that guy's car back in the pit one day laid out. Just too bad they can't hold me. And then D'Angelo tells the story. Okay, so Deidre Cresson dated his own. Of the Wire, Only Wire podcast, episode 4, Still No Wire. Okay, Deidre Cresson, who'd ask D if he fucked her?
This is not gonna be one of my best. I'm trying to crank these out, guys, so they're not all gonna be perfect. All right, fine.
Fucking A. Tap, 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 tap. Fuck me. Flap, 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 flap. What a bitch, it's me, L.A. Matt. Up in that ass with that gas. Big milky titties, flap, flap. In my butthole where I center my orgasm, all the world can eat my butt. Matt Lieb has high blood pressure, red hot chili peppers.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.